The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests. Legendary playwright, screenwriter, and actor Harvey Fierstein is the Tony Award-winning author of Torch Song Trilogy and La Cage aux Folles. He also won Tonys for his performances in Torch Song and as Edna Turnblatt in Hairspray. And he wrote the books for Newsies, Kinky Boots, and Casa Valentina. His play, A Cater to Fair, was nominated for 12 Drama Desk Awards, and he has appeared in dozens of films and television shows, including Mrs. Doubtfire, Independence Day, Cheers, and The Good Wife. As if that weren't enough, and it's only scratching the surface, Fierstein revised the book for the forthcoming Broadway revival of Funny Girl, and now he's written an instant New York Times bestseller, I Was Better Last Night. But tonight, he'll be in conversation with Catherine Cohen, who hosts a weekly cabaret show at Alan Cumming's East Village venue, Club Cumming. Catherine recently published her first book, God, I Feel Modern Tonight, a comedic collection of poetry. If you tune into Netflix on Tuesday, you can catch the premiere of her first comedy special, The Twist, She's Gorgeous. Catherine, Harvey, I'm so glad you're joining us. The screen is yours.
I'm leaving.
Please stay.
Why did he say you're gorgeous and not me? I'm leaving. Andy's left me out of it. I don't know. I can't work like this.
You're gorgeous. Look at this. This is serving America's Next Top Model with the hand on the face.
Well, people ask why you put the hand on the face, because it covers everything else.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to chat with you. It's such an honor to meet you. I have to tell you, Hairspray was the first musical I ever saw on Broadway.
Was it?
I went home and I sang Good Morning Baltimore in my Houston middle school talent show. I had to. I loved it so much. And I've been curled up all weekend with your amazing book. Look at this, stunning. And I was telling Andy, it's so warm. It made me feel very taken care of. So funny, and the way you approach the light and dark moments with such ease. It went by too fast. I need more.
Well, yeah, there always will be more because I got a typewriter.
Yeah, there we go.
If you have a need, I have a typewriter. We can take care of this. No problem. I said, you know, because they are hocking me a chinic about whether to, you're Cohen, right? So you understand if I speak Italian, like hocking me a chinic. No, you don't speak Yiddish.
Here and there.
No Yiddish. Oh, okay. Means hock me in chinic means hit me in the head.
Okay.
They knock me in the head. So they're hocking me in chinic. They're making me crazy. How's that? Making me crazy.
That I can understand.
Yeah, okay, they make me crazy. They keep saying, you know, the book is a New York Times bestseller in a week. So you got to have another book in you. And I said, well, I do. I said, because I didn't write very much about boyfriends in this. I have a long list of victims. And so I thought, you know, maybe I would just do a book just telling stories of the men in my life. And I thought I'd call it Bottomless.
I smell another hit.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's going to smell all right, but I don't know.
So did you always want to write a memoir?
No, I never. No.
How did it happen to you?
Well, COVID. I mean, COVID hit and then Broadway got shut down. It was 2 years ago this week. You know, and I came up to my office and I went, and so I cleaned my desk.
Mm-hmm. Looks great. What
to do? And COVID was still here. So I went to the kitchen, I cleaned the refrigerator. But when it came to cleaning the freezer, I said, no, there's got to be other things to do besides So my agent said, why don't you try writing a memoir? And I said, because I don't write prose that way. I've written op-ed pieces, and I even write commentary on my own stuff. But a book is like a scary kind of thing. And then I thought of my own advice that I do give in the book, which is life does not change if you say no. And I thought, who's going to see it? It's a, you know, it's a computer. It's a keyboard. I can sit here and I could type and stuff, and nobody's ever going to know that I did it or I didn't do it. So I started writing, and I wrote the not the preface, but I wrote the first story that's in the book, the one about being in second grade and wanting to be the evil queen, even cast as a king. So I wrote that story, and it's about how Philomena in my second grade class got to be the evil witch, and I had to be the king. And so I wrote that story, and I sent it to Philomena, because we've been friends since kindergarten.
We're still friends now.
And I sent it to her, figuring if it meant anything to her, maybe it'll mean something to somebody else. That's usually the way I figure things. If it means something to someone, it'll mean something to someone else. So I sent it to her, and she sent back the photograph that's in the book.
Oh, it's an amazing photo.
Yeah, of me at 7 years old in drag. And she had kept that photograph all these years. And so I said, okay, if it meant something to her, let's keep going. And so we did. And
here we are.
And here we are.
Many chapters later. I love the title so much. I was better last night. Is that something you've always felt? Because I think you're getting better with age.
Well, it's you know, it's something that theater people think about. I was better last night because, you know, your friends come backstage after a performance, and you always think, oh, if you had just seen it last night, I was right on it. Ooh, I was right on it. Of course, people only see the performance they see, and they never know, you know, and they can't judge one performance from another. You know, it's like, if they're nice, they'll nod. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean anything to them. So, but it means so much to us who say, I was better last night. So that's why I called it that. But I also used to think that that was the absolute ideal saying for a tombstone.
Yes.
You know, is it not true? You know, once you're buried, you're probably not getting any better.
No, that's kind of the end, isn't it? Last
night, yeah, I was better. But I've since, you know, decided that I'm probably going to go the Lou Grant way. Remember Lou Grant from the Mary Tyler Moore Show? Yeah, you're so young. I have underwear older than you. Lou Grant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, they said, how do you want to be buried? And he said, when I die, just put my hat on and stand me up in the garbage. I kind of feel that way.
Yeah, I want to be thrown sort of near a tree, I think.
Oh, is that what you want? Just
something
covered over the leaves? Not even covered over the leaves?
No, just near. Just something like that. But I wanted to ask you, because you were talking about, you know, saying yes to life versus saying no. You go over so many projects in the book. You're working at a million things at once. How do you know when you want to say yes to something? And has there been an occasion when you have had to say no? And how has that affected you? And did you regret it? Or just, yeah, I'm curious about your process.
The one thing I don't want to do is regret.
Yeah.
I have found that regret is much harder to deal with than failure. Failure I can deal with. Because failure means you tried, you did something. And even if you're absolutely heartbroken at failure, you know that over time it will become a funny story.
Totally. You know,
but regret never turns into a funny story. Regret is just regret. So I really try not to regret stuff. Just before we got on this optical illusion, I still don't believe this really exists.
I'm not real. They're a robot.
I think half of this is like leftover drugs from the 70s. but just before this, somebody called me and offered me something big too. And I thought, I have to make up my mind rather quickly. And I thought, how am I going to make up my mind? My mind is so filled with other stuff I'm doing right now, because I've got the book just launching. Funny Girl is in final rehearsals. It had moved into the theater today.
I'm so excited.
Tomorrow they move into the theater and start rehearsing on the stage. And I've got a lot of this stuff going on, and then somebody's developing a TV show for me. It's never going to happen. But I have a whole bunch of things going on at once. And I said, so how do I now decide about this? Because I don't want to, it's kind of an exciting thing. So sometimes what I do is I just call a bunch of people. I call a bunch of friends and see what they have to say. Not that I ever take anybody's advice, but I think it's interesting to see what their first reaction is. So I called my brother and he said, absolutely not. Let's keep going. Then I called one of my agents, my oldest agent. When he and I met, he was in the mail room at William. Wow. I was his very first client. So I called him. He said, it's a good idea. I thought, okay, maybe I shouldn't do it. And then I called a producer friend of mine, and she said, let's not throw this away so quickly. Let's think. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I am. So I'm still, we're one yes, one no, one let's think. It's only an hour ago.
Do you want my advice? I think it sounds like an amazing opportunity.
See that? So we will think this through. And that's sort of the way you have to do it. You know, like when I was offered Fiddler on the Roof, well, you know, it's like I said, I had just finished 2 years in Hairspray, really wanted some time off. And right. I wanted to just write. And because I'm a kind of a hermit, I like my really quiet life. And then in the theater makes you a very public figure. And so I said, oh, do I really want to take it on? So I called Jack O'Brien, the director of Hairspray. And I said, Jack, what do I do? And he said, very wisely, he said, you either do it or you spend the rest of your life telling people that you were offered it. And they go, yeah, sure.
Oh.
You said I had to do it. Otherwise, people wouldn't believe it. And I'm really glad I did. And had I not done it, I would be regretting it now.
You know, you talk a lot in the book about how you never thought of yourself as a Broadway actor or performer. Was there a moment, you know, you write about the rubber band moment in the book of realizing you can support yourself and you have enough money, you've made it. But was there a moment when you felt like, oh, I'm an actor, this is my thing?
You know, most showbiz books start with like, you know, and then I was a kid and I went to the movies and I looked up at the screen and I said, that's going to be me someday.
Yeah.
Not me. I never wanted to be a writer. I never wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be an artist, but artist is a 1950s word for gay. Oh, he's artistic. Oh, no. So being an artist was fine with me. And I didn't think I was a very good artist, but I went to the High School of Art and Design, which was really a vocational school. Mm-hmm. So we learned to do paste ups. We learned to cut mats. We learned to print photographs. They taught us all this technical stuff. And I knew that in the world of art, I may not be Andy Warhol, but I could work for Andy Warhol and pull silk screens and do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I thought that's what I would be, is I'd be somewhere in the world of art. But once again, just having people ask you, you know, I had this friend in high school whose mother was starting a community theater group. And she said, can you get a bunch of the kids to come down to the church? Because they had no money for posters. And I'll buy some magic markers and some cardboard and you'll all make signs, you know, advertising the show. And so I said, sure, I'll go down there. So we went down. We got, you know, being high school students, we got stoned on the smelling the magic markers, and they said, I want to pull the curtain for the show. And I said, yeah, sure. And the next thing I knew, I was in theater. You know, I was in community theater, but that was theater. And that's the way my life has gone. It's like, I was raised by Ellen Stewart, who is La Mama. For mm-hmm. any of your people would know La Mama at Experimental Theater Club.
Definitely.
And that's where I began. And Ellen was my spiritual mama. And we were together from, I was 16, 17 when I met her until her death. And she taught me to always say no. And say no. When somebody asks you to do something, say no, and then think about it. If you change your mind and say yes later, you are a hero. You've just made them so happy. Mm-hmm. But if you decide to stick with no, you haven't disappointed them anymore. By the time you've thought about it, they're already over it. And I thought, that's not right. That's not right. When you're living your life all day long, people are asking you to do stuff. You don't even hear it. Somebody calls you up and says, you want to go for coffee? You want to do this? You want to do that? We don't even hear it. It's just automatic that we say no, because I'm doing something. I'm busy. I'm reading this. I have to get this done. I can't meet you for coffee. I got to do this. Truthfully, nothing happens if you say no. Mm-hmm. If you say no, you're going to finish whatever's on your desk. That's true. But you don't know what would have happened had you gone out for coffee. Maybe nothing at all. Maybe you would have met the love of your life. Maybe mm-hmm. you would have got hit by a car. Maybe you would have done a scratch off and won $1 billion. You don't know. But saying no doesn't change anything. Only saying yes does. So as much as I can, and my philosophy and advice to people is as much as you possibly can, try and say yes. And see what it happens, see what where it takes you. So by saying yes, I was offered this, I was offered that, I did this, I did that. Somebody said, write a play, I wrote a play, you know, and life happens. So I didn't plan it. I was not one of those people driven to have a career. People say, you know, how hard was it to become a Broadway star? Mm-hmm. Start out wanting to be a Broadway star. It was never a goal of mine. It's a lovely thing. And I certainly appreciate it, but it's just about saying yes.
Once you started saying yes, you kept working so hard for so many years. I'm so curious. You talk a lot about your
Working hard. You have to, no matter what you do, you better work hard.
Yeah.
If you're not going to work hard at it, then really don't bother. If it's not something you can do, if it's not something that inspires you to work hard, then don't even bother. Stay home. You're only going to annoy the people who are working hard.
How do you take care of yourself when you're working on so many projects at once? And I know you've struggled with your voice and everything. I'm so curious, are there like any rituals or things you like to do while you're in a show or?
Yeah, but you learn about yourself over the years. I'm going to be 70 in June. I've been doing this a really long time. So you figure yourself out. You know who you are. You know how things feel. You know what's right for you. Sometimes you make mistakes. When I was doing Bella Bella, this play that I wrote about Bella Abzug, it was a one-man show at the Manhattan Theater Club. And they came to me with the schedule. And I said, you know, it's only 80 minutes long. I can knock off two of these a day for several days in a row and then have an extra day off instead. Well, by the time I was done, my ego just really said, I can do anything. It's only 80 minutes. And I put together a schedule that nearly killed me. I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah, I ended up on steroids and.
Oh no.
It was a mess. I actually had to miss one performance. And yeah, because I had so messed up that schedule that I ended up, I think it was 14 days without a day off and double shows every day. It was just.
Oh my God.
Stupid. So yeah, so your ego can lead you in the wrong. That's one thing that can lead you in the wrong direction. If you just believe in yourself too much, you can get in trouble. A couple of times I've gotten myself in trouble that way, but I did learn from that, and I would never do that again.
And when you were growing up, was your family always supportive of your artistic aspirations? I know you and your brother are so close, and yeah. Such a nice thing about your relationship.
Well, my father called us the Bandits, which is Yiddish for crooks. Because he never thought that either one of us, my brother or I, could earn a living. He was sure we would never be able to earn a living. He was just so sure we would just starve in the street. He used to say to us all the time, you do know I'm not leaving you anything, right? You know, when I die, nothing. So you really need to get a job or do something. He really didn't have a lot of faith. He did live long enough to see me make more money than he was making per week. So my family was very, very supportive of whatever. My mother loved the arts. Mm-hmm. She loved that I went into the arts. And my brother was in the arts also, but he was smart enough to go back to school and get his degree as a lawyer. And he became a lawyer, which has allowed him to do all kinds of stuff, including running my life. My brother does run my life, which is good. Because who are you gonna trust? Well, who are you going to trust? You know, it's like I say, if he bankrupts me, you know, his kids are going to get whatever I have. So if he bankrupts me, then his kids get nothing and I'm going to move in with him. Make sure I don't end up bankrupt.
How, I'm curious, reading about when Torch Song became a hit was so beautiful in the book. What was that like for you when all of a sudden it was, you know, you thought it was going to shut and then everything just, the world opened to you. What was that like?
I didn't think it was going to shut. I hoped it would shut. The show, we had moved the show from off-Broadway to off-Broadway, mm-hmm. where it became this unbelievable hit. And I tell the story, and all these stories are in the book, but I tell a story in the book that I came up out of the subway one day and saw a line from the box office on 7th Avenue around that went wrapped around the corner past the liquor store and disappeared around the second corner. And I thought, oh my God, I'll never get out of this. It was a small theater, so we could easily sell it out. I was writing La Caja Fall already, and I had finished a play called Spook House. So I had these two things I wanted to go off and do, but I'm stuck doing Torch Song. And I'm thinking, I'm like, oh my God, how do I get out of this? And they came to me and asked if we would move to Broadway. And I said no. And then I thought, you know what? It'll never make it on Broadway. So I'll let it move to Broadway. I'll get some money because they have to pay you to go to Broadway. I'll get a Broadway credit, you know, to say on my resume, he was on Broadway. And the show will close and I can go on with my life. It ran 5 years.
And why did you think it wouldn't make it on Broadway?
Well, we talked about this before on the air. I've already promised to not use the terminology. Andy has asked me not to use the terminology to tell you of why it would not make it on Broadway. But let us just say the show is a little raw.
Fair enough.
Torch Song was not your average Broadway fare for the time. There was not a lot of honest depictions of gay life. And this was a play that certainly was an honest depiction of gay life. So I just didn't think. I mean, I'd seen other shows try on mm-hmm. Broadway and not make it. You know, even something like Boys in the Band only played off Broadway. Right. They didn't try to bring it to Broadway. Staircase bombed. There were a lot of gay plays that didn't make it. So I had no great dreams that it was going to. And then it did.
And then what was it like to kind of begin to transition into some film and TV stuff? I Mrs. Doubtfire is like one of my all-time favorite movies. It's a classic. It's the best. Was that one of your favorite things you've ever worked on, or what was your favorite film role?
No, I don't like movies or television at all. I used to do one movie or one or two voices a year so mm-hmm. that to pay for healthcare. Because you're on your union. Well, you know this. On your union, you have to make a certain amount of money each year. Plus the money you make from residuals in order to keep your health care. So I would do one or two movies a year or one or two voices. I finally realized I could do voices, and this way I didn't even have to get dressed up and go do a movie. Movies, it's a different energy, a completely different energy. It's not that I hate them. I love watching movies. I just don't like being in them because you sit around all the time. You know, it's all about the technical thing. It's all about getting the lighting right and getting the camera in the right place and all that stuff. And so you're sitting in the trailer, sort of dying, saying, let me go home and slit my wrists rather than sit in this trailer for another hour. And some people know how to do it. Like I remember Sally Field, she learned to needlepoint. She'd been doing television since she was 17, 18 years old. And so I think everyone in her family and all of her friends have 700-800 needlepoint pillows, because that's what she did. She would just sit in needlepoint, and some people did drugs. I couldn't write because you never knew when they were going to call you, and you're in a little trailer. I just don't like it. So I do it when it's a favor for a friend or whatever, like Billy Eichner.
Love
Billy on the street. He just wrote and starred in a movie and called me up and said, would you do a guest spot on it? And I said, and he said, please. And I said, okay, if you get rid of me in one day, you make it a tiny role so I can come in, shoot one day, and gone. And that's what he did for me, which was very sweet. So I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to get there. And didn't get out of there till 10 at night. Like, is it that, you know, you do a Broadway show, the show's 2 hours long, in, you're out.
Are you eager to get back on stage?
Maybe, I don't know. It's got to be the right thing. Like I said, I don't do, that's not just who I am. You know, I don't just write, I don't just act, I don't just make quilts, I don't just paint. Mm-hmm. I do all kinds of things, and they all interest me. And I'm also a hermit. I do have no problem of just locking myself in my house with my dogs and, you know, seeing my friends. And unless it's something I really want to do, I have no need to, you know. There are people who just like, what's next? What's next? You know,
right.
That's just not me.
Well, I'm so excited to see Funny Girl. What was the process like of revising the book?
It was difficult because it's been 7 years. They called me maybe six years ago. They called me, David Babani and Sonia Freeman, these two wonderful English producers. Mm-hmm. And David Babani has a small theater in London called the Meunier Chocolate Factory, where they had done Torch Song. They did Lacage, and they're fabulous. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. They do these like shrunk down versions of Broadway musicals, and many of them have been very successful. And anyway, we were already friends, and they contacted me about Funny Girl. And I thought, you know, here's a show that hasn't been revived in 50 years. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me take a look at it. So I got the script and I read it. And I saw something that I'd heard all the stories about Funny Girl. They wrote a show and they started putting it up. And I think they went through two choreographers, three directors. People were quitting left and right. Book writers, everything else. They were out of town. They were in all this trouble. And I know what that feels like to be out of town and in trouble. You just panic. And what happened with Funny Girl was they just glued it together as best they could. They had Barbara Streisand. She was this rock, you know, she was going to give this incredible vocal performance and be funny also. And so they basically just threw away the show and said, let's just stick her up there. We'll let the whole thing ride on her personality. And, you know, and then we'll get away with it with that. And they did. She was phenomenal in the show. And they got away with it. And it became a big hit show. It ran a couple of years. But it was the Barbara Streisand show. And everybody did it in her mold. They imitated what she had done. So it wasn't about... This is a show about Fanny Brice, who's a real person. And it was telling the Fanny Brice story, but it sort of became the Barbara Streisand story instead.
Right.
And so I looked at it and I said, well, we're not under pressure right now. I've got the time to look at the book. I have the time to work with the director and see what he thinks. And so we did that. And we did a lot of it. The people who own the rights, you know, the children of the people who actually put it together in the first place, they were a little nervous about letting us change stuff. They held me back a little bit, but we created a show, we put it on, and it was a huge hit at the Meunier Chocolate Factory. We moved it to the West End, which is Broadway. It ran a year. Then we sent it out on a whole year tour, where it did fabulously well. And then we were supposed to bring it into New York and COVID hit.
Right.
So we had to sit on it for 2 years. And then I got the call saying, you know, COVID won't last forever. Let's get back to work on it. So all of a sudden I was back at the computer looking at it again. I got to take another look at it. I got to say, okay, now we're doing it not for an English audience, but for an American audience. The creators of the original show trusted me a little bit more because I had made it into a hit in London. So they let me go a little further. And so I'm very pleased with what we've done. We'll see that, you know, in the long run, we people who put these shows together, we can do whatever we want and make ourselves as happy as we like. It's the audience. The audience has to come in and have a good time. If the audience doesn't come in and have a good time, don't mean nothing. So in the long run, we'll see what the audience thinks, but I think they're going to have a good time.
I cannot wait. I love Beanie. I think it's going to be fabulous.
Well, Beanie's a lot of fun. And the other thing is, you know, the fun part for somebody like me is I don't want the audience to ever know what I did. You're going to see Funny Girl, and you shouldn't actually be able to tell what I did and what I didn't do. Did he restructure that? Did he put that song? What happened to that? You should not even know what I did. You should just see the Funny Girl of you. It's like Newsies, you know, the kids who fell in love with Newsies when they were little kids, they came to see the show. They could point out a couple of things, you know, that they were different. But in the long run, they had no idea how much I had changed. And that's the job of a revisionist, is to not leave your fingerprints on it, to make it look like what it was before. And that's really a fun job.
Wonderful. I'm curious, you know, you started in such avant-garde, experimental kind of downtown theater scene, and now you do all kinds of things, you know, mainstream Disney musicals, all kinds of things. What's it been like writing for such a larger audience? Like, how was that transition for you?
It's not that, you know, it's you're always writing for the truth, and you're not, no, I mean, do you have expectations? It depends on what you're writing, you know. If I'm writing a play and I'm just writing a play myself, I don't think about that at all. I'm just being true to the characters. It's my job is to present the characters and the story as best I can, and I don't think of the audience. The audience has to catch up to me. When you're writing a musical, you can think that way, but then you've got a composer and a lyricist, and then it's the three of you doing this work together, and then all of a sudden there's a director, and the director's brain comes into it, and you know, and it, and at some point, then you've got producers and everything else. And at some point, I said this to somebody who was writing their first musical. I said this the other day, you know, it could be your sperm and somebody else's egg. And somebody else's womb, but in the long run, that baby is that baby, and that baby belongs to itself, and it's not yours, and it's not one other person's. The baby is the child, is the child, and it will grow up to be who it needs to grow up to be. You can only support it, you can take care of it, you can help it grow, but in the long run, that child is going to be that child, and you need to let it go. So no, you don't think of it the way you're thinking at all. Your brain just doesn't go there.
And how does it feel having the book, this child out in the world?
Well, that's different because that's more like writing a play, because that is you. And I mean, the good part is you get it off your back. You know, those stories out of your head. The bad part is when somebody says, well, you blah, 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 and you go, well, that's not true. Well, I read it in your book. That's the bad part. Can't lie about it anymore. But beyond that, it's also only been out for a little while. I let very few people read it when I was writing it. Very few of my friends, even like one friend at a time, read it because I wanted them to have the experience of reading the book, and I didn't want them reading pages or whatever. You know, some people let you read all kinds of stuff. I didn't want that. So my friends read it, you know, like 2 weeks ago when I started getting the copies of the book. And it's funny, some people in the book I've never heard from again. I guess that's bound to happen.
That's life. That's exciting.
And you have to think about, you know, why. Maybe they're adjusting to what I said. You know, I'm telling my point. You know, when I wrote the book, before I wrote the book, I called Shirley MacLaine, who's written nine autobiographies or memoirs. And I figured, who better than she to give me advice? And I asked her, and she said, you need to let memory be your editor. Write what you remember. Whether it's true or not, it's what's in your heart that's important. And I said, well, I care less about myself. There's a lot of people in the book, a lot of that are dead and you know, died very young because of AIDS and other stuff. And I said, you know, I want to be true to their stories. And she said, you can't do that. She said, you can only write about how they affected you. If you're really truthful, you're still writing about yourself even when you're writing about them. So just leave it at that, and tell the truth as best as it comes up for you, which is what I did. I then changed a lot of names. A couple of people asked me not to change their names, but most of the people in the book have really enjoyed. A couple of people are pissed that they're not in the book.
But I'm sure it's an honor to be included.
I know, but it's like you can't name, you know, you just can't keep naming names because the reader goes, should I remember this name? Should I never have always? You don't want to do that. You don't want it to turn into a thing where you're just like jerking off your friends by naming names. I mean, there's one chapter that starts, I think, something like Jill Bray was a drug addict and blah 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 blah. And she's never mentioned again in the entire book. But it was so important to start it out with the personal, with there was this person. And and everything came from this person. It was just, you know, artistically, it was important to have her name. But in other things, it's not, you know. But I did get some complaints that they're not in the book. The other reason I put in a long acknowledgement at the end, in alphabetical order, so I wouldn't get like, how could you put the door before me? And then I listed all my pets, so I wouldn't get in trouble with them. Starting with my childhood, with my very first dog, right through my dogs now, every one of my pets of my life, not the alligator. And not the hamsters. I didn't bother with the hamsters or the alligator.
I think they're going to be pretty upset.
They did.
It is what it is. Have you kept journals or diaries throughout your life, or is this truly just from the heart?
I'm a very bad journal keeper. Like most people, you only keep a journal when you're really bored or really in pain,
and then really depressed.
They're no use. When you're writing out of that emotional, well, that's what you're writing. Well, it makes sense. If you're writing just that, I mean, I have a diary, which actually is holding up this computer. My computer is held up by the 2-volume set of Stephen Sondheim's Look, I Made a Hat, which is how I chose my editor of my book, because he edited those 2 books for Sondheim. The book all the way at the bottom is this diary, which I've had since the early 70s. And I think there's maybe 25 pages written on it.
It's hard to fill them up. I agree. It's for when you're depressed.
There's no reason to. I was the only part of it that because I did look at it before I wrote the book and while I was writing the book. And I do have several dreams that were interesting to go back and try and figure out what those dreams were. But none of that ended up in the book.
I think we're almost going to head to the Q&A, but I'm curious, what advice do you have for young artists starting out in the world right now?
Go get a real job.
It's good advice.
That's the advice I kept getting. Go get a real job. I went to school. You know, I lived this very funny triple life. I was this nice Jewish boy who lived at home. And, you know, live this nice life. Then I was going to art school during the day. So that was that double life. And I was studying to be an artist, but I also was taking enough credits to be a teacher.
All right.
And then at night, I was in the underground theater and art movement. So what was really funny was I'd go to history of art and my teacher would lecture about somebody. And then I'd be spending the evening with that person. And say, okay. Oh, you heard the lecture about you today. And, you know, so I knew these people. So I didn't even take tests to get out of college. I just gave out tickets to my shows or introduced people. I mean, you know, how many people do you know who knew Anais Nin? You know, it's like.
That story is insane. Yeah, do you still read tarot?
Well, no. You know where the tarot cards are. I told the truth of where they are.
Wow, really?
No, did
never again.
They were buried. They were buried by the Alice in Wonderland statue in Central Park.
Fabulous. Well, thank you. Should we turn to some of the Q&A questions?
Yeah, do what they want.
If y'all are watching and you want to ask Harvey a question, just feel free to type in the Q&A questions. Let's see what do we have here.
Maybe Andy's wife is back.
Well, yeah. Let's see. This says, Topher asks, can you share a memory or two about working with and knowing Robin Williams?
I mean, once again, you know, it's one of those things, there's more subtlety to it in the book, but I loved Robin. I loved working with him. He was a very obviously a genius, but he was very disciplined. You know, you think of him as being totally undisciplined, but it takes a lot of discipline to train your brain to do what he did, to just do that stream of consciousness. That's a lot of work. You know, he admired Jonathan Winters and learned from Jonathan Winters to do that. And then he studied that and trained himself, and he became this absolute master at stream of consciousness. And it was fascinating to watch, but obviously that wasn't the best parts of him. Those were the private.
Another listener, viewer asks, how have theater audiences changed throughout your career?
Very, very different. There's a story in the book about Torch Song specifically. When we opened Torch Song on Broadway, the audiences were probably 80 to 85% heterosexual. And then the gays that came in, the 15% of gays that would come in, were sort of like, you know, with hoodies up, you know, and they're sneaking into the theater. Nobody should see them going into a gay play, or, you know, or bringing a date, you know, female date with them or whatever. There was a danger. It was like going to the black market, you know, it was something dangerous and wonderful and sitting there and hearing something so revolutionary, somebody demanding respect and all that. It was dangerous. I guess that's the best word for it. They revived the show in 2018. And I'm sitting there in the audience watching the audience come in, and now it's 85% gay. Mm-hmm. They're not walking in hidden. They're walking in with ownership of it. They're walking in with pride. They're walking in bringing younger people with them to see what they saw, or younger people who knew about it coming to see what this was that they'd heard about years ago. And the show didn't even belong to me anymore. It belonged to the community. It was theirs, and they had ownership of it. And that was very fascinating. And still, in the third act, when the mother came out, they all turned into 5-year-olds again. Mm-hmm. Just the power of mothers over us.
Totally perpetual. Speaking of, another question we have is, looking back at the beginning of your professional life, have LGBTQ+ representation and depiction in film/stage come as far as you would have thought they'd come?
You know, we have stories to tell. I don't like thinking that anybody can ever represent the community. Nobody can. Mm-hmm. I can't represent the community. You can't represent the community. And it's an absolutely stupid thing to look to say, I'm going to see Brokeback Mountain because it's going to represent the LGBT. No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. Story. Nobody stops Neil Simon and says, what's it like being a heterosexual? And Plaza Suite, what does that say about heterosexuality? It's a stupid idea to even think that someone could. It's not our job as artists. Our job as artists is to tell a story, to entertain, maybe to enlighten, but to tell a story that's hopefully human enough that other people can identify, even if they're heterosexual. So I don't think this idea that a gay, you know, that, I mean, it's absurd.
Totally. Well, I went back and watched. I'd seen it before, your interview with Barbara Walters, where you give the, you know, the famous responses about, you know, I assume everyone's gay until proven otherwise. And I thought what you wrote about. I agree with that for sure. All right, we have time for probably one or two more questions. Let's see. Oh yeah, you spoke a lot about recovery and sobriety in the book, which I thought was fascinating. Could you comment more about the role of recovery in your life that you write about in the book? Is what wants someone. Yes.
Yeah. The thing is, everybody has a different path with with abuse, and in my business, you know, in the arts and. It's like, who isn't in recovery? If they're not in recovery, they're actively gonna get there. So it's not such a strange thing in my world. But I had a lover who got sober first. I went to Al-Anon. So when it was time for me to get sober, I already had the 12-step background. I already knew exactly what I was walking into. Yeah, there was no great surprise there. So when I went to my first AA meeting, which was... You have to read the book because it doesn't happen overnight. It happened years, you know. But by the time I stopped drinking, I was drinking half a gallon of Southern Comfort a day, 100 proof. So you got to work your way up to that, because that will kill you if you try doing that on one day's notice. So by the time I got sober, I was ready to just give it up. I don't mean booze, I meant give up life. My life was over. My life, my choices, my life had led me to the end of my life. So I was willing to say, you take it over now. And I have lived these 25 and a half years, in August it'll be 26 years, I've lived them as if I'm reborn into a new life. And everything that happens is a gift. And I don't take anything for granted, and I don't feel like I deserve anything. It's all been a gift since then, because the life that I was making for myself was not getting me any place good. So, yeah, so there's a lot of stuff. I don't get to many meetings anymore, but most of my friends are program people. And not just because, you know, it's just because you get really bored hanging out with people getting drunk.
Yeah.
It's enough fun. There's a saying, you know, when you hear the alcohol talking, get up and go and leave. And so, you know, I'd just rather hang out with people that aren't going to drink, and I don't have to listen to it.
You wrote in the book also about getting bored of casual sex. What was that? I thought that was very interesting as well. What was that like?
Once again, it's not a story you can really tell. That's what a library is. We'll put it this way. I was doing some activities during which a line of Colette's came to me, which was when he and he and he became them, I gave up men. That was the way I felt. I felt like, I don't even care anymore. These penises mean nothing to me, and these people attached to them mean nothing. And so let me try something else. The giving up cigarettes.
That was a fascinating story. I was like, I need to go to this hypnotherapist that you worked with.
But I don't know that's just it. You know, she actually asked me to write something for her, and I said, but I don't know that that's what did it. I think I was... I gave up smoking at a spa, that's true, but I think I was in so much pain at that time that I could have given up anything. I mean, when your soul is in so much pain, it's like, you're gonna hurt me some more, go ahead and hurt me. I gave up alcohol, caffeine, and cigarettes. And now, and then it was like, everyone knows that I'm addicted to Diet Coke, well, a caffeine-free Diet Coke, but I gave that up too. So like every place I go, they know about me. So they have bottles of Diet Coke for me. And I say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't drink that anymore either. I'll drink one just so they don't feel bad that they went and bought a six pack for me. But, but yeah, so, it does, you know, giving up stuff is kind of interesting.
You mentioned it took sort of 5 years to feel like you were clear-headed or coming back into your life again. How did that change your creative process?
That's what they tell you. They tell you that it takes 5 years to get your marbles back, is the way they put it. Well, in 12-step program, they tell you don't do anything for the first year. Make no major changes in the first year. If you're in a bad relationship, but you can stay there, stay there. Mm-hmm. If you're in a bad job, but you can stay there, stay there. Don't make no major change because you're so fragile and you don't really know what you're doing. So I did that. And then, you know, and then I took some jobs and stuff like that, but it did just worked out that at the end of the 5 years, there was Hairspray. It was kind of like magical. I went, oh, here's my marbles and here's the next real beginning of the next chapter of my life.
You speak about being an atheist, but do you believe in fate or that things happen for a reason? Complete random.
Yeah, absolutely. I pray, but yeah. I don't pray to anything. There's nobody sitting in a chair listening, and there's no heaven, there's no hell. It's just too random. It's too stupid to think. And I mean, how egotistical do you have to be to think that you go on after this world? That there's a heaven filled with all these people. And I say, well, if there is a heaven, you know, who do you talk to? I have a lot of friends. I wouldn't have time to talk to all of them if I had to. And, you know, if you're a little kid when you die, you're three, you're going to stay 3 years old for eternity, and your mother, and if you remarried and the second marriage was better, you're still stuck with, in the Jewish religion, you know, if this isn't enough to prove that they're just full of crap, in the Jewish religion, the you know, heavy duty Hasids believe that if a woman is a great wife and you know, and takes care of the house and keeps kosher and obeys her husband and does everything the way she's supposed to, that when she dies, she gets to be her husband's footstool.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Hell. Ain't
that enough to send you out drinking?
That's tough.
Exactly. You can't believe in that crap.
I don't know what I believe anymore after hearing that.
You seem to be a smart kind of person. I bet you know. I love that, and I also love that that Ron Reagan Jr. commercial. You know, for the freedom from religion. Have you seen that? Mm-hmm. Oh, he has a spot raising money for freedom from religion or one of those atheist groups. And it's like, you know, he says it's very important to keep religion out of our politics and blah, blah, blah. And it ends with Ron Reagan Jr. not afraid to burn in hell. That's such a great way to end a commercial.
That's a great headstone line as well.
Yeah. I'm right here.
I'm curious about, you talk about having this major surgery, and would you call it like a near-death experience, or just what were the emotions you felt after kind of waking back up? I was so curious about that.
I had change of valve. Yeah, that's what it's called. It's called a valve.
Valve.
I knew I could figure that one out. Change your valve. So basically they kill you, you know, they shut you off so they can do the work they need to do. And then they put you back online and bring you back to life. And I was angry. When I woke up, I was angry. Like, what the fuck? See, I had promised you'd have to bring up that stuff. We're in a library. And now we've said something.
I'm offended.
Yeah, well, at least it's you. So when they woke me back up, I was really angry. Like, everything was nice and quiet. It was over. Mm-hmm. It was blackness. There was nothing. I didn't know I was dead. It was just, I knew I was dead when they woke me up. And I said, that was so nice. Leave me alone. And you bring me back to where I'm freezing cold and I'm angry and I'm in pain and I've got tubes coming out of me everywhere and wires I was really angry. And I spoke to a bunch of other people who felt the same way after having that kind of an operation. Mm-hmm. And I said, why don't they tell you? Why don't they warn you? You're on this, you know, they put your brain to sleep, right? But you're not dead. Your brain actually is recording all of that stuff. It's not recording it in a place that you can bring it back, but your brain knows what's going on in the rest of your body. And they don't warn you that you're going to have these very strong feelings from being so viciously violated. You know, they took saws and they cut you, you know, and I'm sure there were lots of conversations you really didn't want to listen in on.
Oh my God, truly. About
you and they don't warn you. And so whenever I have a friend that goes in for heavy duty surgery, I warn them, you may have these negative feelings when you wake up. You may feel that way. It's because these drugs are incredibly powerful. There was all this stuff going on that your brain knows about. Let it go. Just let it breathe through it. Just remember, it's not real. They're only feelings. Let it all go. But nobody warned me. I wish they had, because my whole concentration was act happy. Act happy. If you act miserable and you let them know how you're feeling, they'll never let you out of this hospital. Mm. So act happy. I did everything I could. The second I could get out of bed, I was out of bed, and there was like a little staircase practicing, and I was running up and down that staircase to prove I was doing well. And I wouldn't spend any time in my bed at all. I sat out in the waiting room. I spent all my time, made believe I was working on the computer. I couldn't concentrate or do anything. But
oh my God.
Because I just wanted to look normal to get out of there. And it worked. I got out much earlier than I should have.
Go ahead.
But I came home and a friend brought over Chinese food. I was sitting at my dining room table and we're eating. And I said, oh, I'm dripping soup all over myself. And then realized, no, I wasn't. There was a hole in my chest and there was liquid coming out of it. I was still draining. I called the doctor and I said, this may not be a good sign, but I've got like a cup and a half, like holding a glass under my chest. And this like, oh, it's okay. You're just draining extra. Like, it's just saline.
Oh, casual.
Why don't they tell you that?
No one tells you anything. That's why we need your book.
Doctors don't tell you. You got to read the book.
You guys got to read the book. It's juicy. It's warm. You know,
Exactly.
I love it. I think that's about it. As right. we have a nice comment from someone named Marie saying you are the best, and I agree. Thank you so much.
Right. You are you going to see Alan coming here? He just worked at the theater. He's going to be here in my small fictional town in Connecticut. You know, he's doing that show with a friend of his.
Oh, with Ari Shapiro.
Yeah. They're like in 2 Saturdays or 3 Saturdays from now.
Amazing. So I haven't seen their show. I need to go see it. But I see him every now and then at the club. Yeah, he comes and he bartends.
Oh, good. Well, tell him hello.
I will. He's the best.
Since we did Gently Downstream and he came.
Oh, amazing.
So, thank you so much.
Thank you for your book. It's fabulous.
Thank you for having it. And everybody, it's available.
It's available, y'all.
Available.
Don't be shy.
Time to be a major motion picture.
Oh, it'd be a long one.
Just teasing.
All right. Have a great night.
Thank you for doing this with us.
Of course. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.